My name is Angela Hornsby, and I'm speaking with Elder Wade Bowick at his office at United for Christ Church in Durham, North Carolina. The date is April 9th, 1999, and we're here as part of the Southern Oral History Program's New Immigrants Project. And Mr. Bowick, I was just wondering if you could state your name for the record.
My name is Wade Charles Bowick.
And when and where were you born?
I was born in the Brooklyn Jewish Hospital, Brooklyn, New York.
Mm-hmm. Were you named after someone in your family?
Well, I was supposed to be named after my grandfather, but I ended up with his middle name, mm-hmm. which is Charles, mm-hmm. which was supposed to be my first name, but my mother had the better sense to change that. I don't like that name for some reason, but ended up with Wade Charles.
Okay. And I was wondering if you could tell me a little bit about your grandparents and your parents.
Well, as far as we know, the family is traceable by photographs and oral history back to my great-great-grandmother mm-hmm. On my mother's side. They originated in Virginia, Richmond, Virginia. I investigated some property there that was passed down to my grandmother and found out that my great-great-grandfather purchased the land in lots from the previous slave owner. So mm-hmm. it was pretty enlightening experience. The deed was handwritten with wax seals.
Wow.
And he bought it in four portions.
Wow.
And it was handed down through the family, and my mother, I think, was the last one that was actually born in the house, which is still there, still standing.
Wow.
On my father's side, they are from East Orange, New Jersey. And again, it goes back to his mother's mother mm-hmm. as far as traceable history. Here lately, with the internet, I'm beginning to find, or family members are beginning to find me now.
Mm-hmm.
So it's getting interesting. Had some calls from New Zealand.
Wow.
But some interesting things. But basically, that's how far back that we know mm-hmm. The family to go and to actually know the members from that point on. Now, what has happened since then, my grandmother and my mother passed away, and with them passed away all of the phone numbers and the contacts mm-hmm. because they're the ones who kept mm-hmm. close contact with the families, and the rest of the families all over the country. So I guess the only chance we have now to regroup is through the internet.
That seems
to be what's happening.
Interesting. What did your what was the occupation of your parents?
My grandmother was a seamstress mm-hmm. in New York in the unions, and she worked there for many years making baby doll clothes. Mm. And then she decided she didn't want to do that when she was 60 years old, quit, went to school, became a baby nurse.
Wow.
And did that until she wasn't able to work anymore.
Mm.
My mother was a seamstress, again, working in the union shop, and she did that all of her life. My father was a bus driver, long distance is what he ended up with. He started off with the trolleys in Brooklyn, and he was a correction officer for a brief period of time, and then he became a professional bus driver,
mm-hmm.
and that's what he did for a better portion of his life.
Mm-hmm. Did you have any siblings?
One sister.
Mm-hmm.
One sister. She's here in Durham. As a matter of fact, she moved here before we did,
mm-hmm.
About 5 years before we came. And we're all here because we got sick and tired of New York. At that time, it was just getting crazy.
What was so crazy about it?
It was just the quality of life was just, it's just a rat race.
Mm-hmm.
You know, crime and rushing and subways breaking down, and expensive and too much trouble, and so we decided. Or, as a matter of fact, I was working with the New York Times, and a job opened up in Sanford, North Carolina, and I applied for it. And since my sister was here in Durham, we moved here, and then I commuted to Sanford until they sold the company.
What did you do with the New York Times?
I was in their book division. It was called Arnold Press Publishing Company. And I transferred down to Microfilming Corporation, which was a division of the New York Times, as a purchasing manager. And I did that until they sold the company.
Okay, so you officially came down from Brooklyn what year?
1981.
Okay, that's right. Okay. Sort of backtracking just a little bit, I was wondering if you could give me a flavor of what it was like growing up in Brooklyn.
Well, my father left home when I was four, so I was sent down to Richmond to live with my aunt and uncle.
Excuse me, gentlemen, that's the order.
And I was four, and before I left, we lived in a middle-class project, which was pretty well segregated at the time, in a very nice neighborhood. And I went to Richmond at the age of four until the age of 10. So it was 6 years spent down there. And I was kind of rough around the edges coming from New York when I got there. And I learned discipline. We went to church. And my excuse me, my aunt got sick and eventually passed away with cancer. My uncle was a brick mason, so he was unable to take care of me, so they sent me back to Brooklyn. Now, by that time, my mother and father had split up, and we ended up in the low-income projects in this place called Brownsville, Brooklyn, which is kind of noted for gangs and trouble. And that's exactly what was going on when I got back. And it was a horrible transition for me to come from 10-acre piece of property with chickens and cows and farm life to a little cubicle in a 110-family project and get involved with the street gangs and the fighting and all the crazy mess going on at that time.
Were you involved in gang activity?
Well, the thing about it at that time is that if you lived in the neighborhood, whether you belonged to the gang or not, you were associated with the neighborhood, and gang was synonymous. So whether you belonged to the gang or not, and they found out, you know, they called it territory. You know, well, you live over there, that's your turf, and that, you know. So it was an automatic thing. So actually you had to travel in groups for protection. Illustration, when they had a certain supermarket in the wrong territory that used to have chickens on sale all the time, my mother would say, go over there and get some of those chickens. And it was an adventure because you could get killed going to get some chickens, you know what I mean? So it was a transition, and like anything else, you get used to it. You know, you get there and there's signs, keep off the grass, don't climb the trees when you come from the country, you know. And then the winters were cold and, you know, so it took maybe about 2 years to get adjusted to that life. And for instance, I have a story in, well, my sister had, she never left, so she stayed with my mother during that period. And I came out in the park to play. I was there a couple of days. And my mother called for dinner, you know, call out the winner, come, y'all come on up and eat. And as you can see, I didn't miss too many meals in my life. So I get ready to go, you know, I was collecting my glove and stuff, and they started jumping on me, and inchy-pinchy, you know, and I'm going like, what are you talking about, you know? So the rule was that you couldn't quit, or if you, they called it inchy-pinchy, so they had to give you either 50 punches or a kick in the jaw. So when I was leaving, you know, they started hitting me, so I'm fighting out. So my sister's yelling, so I'm going, get my bat, you know, never mind yelling, you know. So anyway, after that all went down, we all ended up being best of friends. But the rule was, you know, the inchy pinchy meant that if you quit anything,
mm-hmm.
then you got 50 punches or you settle for a kick in the jaw. You know, I'm talking literally, you know. So you learn that kind of fast. So then you just join the rest of them. It was kind of a tough life with the gang environment, even though I did not belong to a gang.
Mm-hmm.
Just living in the neighborhood mm-hmm. associated you with the territory.
Mm-hmm.
You see? So you had to defend yourself. And I remember days running down the railroad tracks, trying to get the subway tracks next to the third rail, getting away and, you know, shooting and all kind of crazy stuff. But being a man of faith, I just thank God that I'm still here.
Mm-hmm.
So,
it
was rough.
This sort of inculcation of faith, what did that come from the time you were in Virginia, or were your parents really religious?
Well, at that age, you know, if they were, I didn't know about it.
Mm-hmm.
But they sent me down to Virginia, and my aunt and uncle, well, actually, my aunt was, she was a school teacher, and when I got there, it was a two-room schoolhouse.
Mm-hmm.
And I had three grades in each classroom, with a pot-bellied stove in the middle, right off from the cemetery.
That what time period are we talking about here?
That was kindergarten, because I was 4 years old.
Around what years?
What, 48, 49, 50, 51, 52, 53, somewhere. Mm-hmm. And then I think after a couple of years of that, they built a new brick school, and everything was still segregated at that time.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a black school. And, I mean, it was a real school, so that was interesting. But she had the qualifications to become principal.
Mm-hmm.
So she ended up as, I believe, the first black principal in that area down there. So that was a big deal.
Mm-hmm. Is this Richmond?
Richmond,
okay.
Yeah, Henrico mm-hmm. County. So also, that's when I was introduced to Mount Calvary Church and to the Baptist Church, so I knew something about religion at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And before she died, she made my mother and grandmother promise that they would keep me in the church, which they did.
Interesting.
And that was an experience in the Baptist Church in Brooklyn, but I stayed there until I decided to leave,
mm-hmm.
17, 18 years old. And some things happened in my life to bring me right back where I start. You know, the Bible says, train up a child in the way that he should go.
Mm-hmm.
And I think when my mother passed suddenly, I guess my spirituality was grieving. So that was the impetus to bring me back into a closer walk.
So you're saying that?
Well, there were some other things, you know, but basically, I got a call. My oldest son, we had his birthday party, and I got a call from a neighbor. And by the way, she was packing up. This was in September,
mm-hmm.
and maybe 15 years ago, I forget the exact date. And she was packing to come, because I gave her an ultimatum. I said, you are leaving, and you are coming. And we found her a job and everything. And the neighbor called and said, I just dropped your mother off at the emergency. You know, I don't know what's wrong. And she said, when she walked through the door, she started to drag her feet, you know. So we're calling the hospital like crazy. Of course, they don't give you any mm-hmm. information on the telephone. So we all hopped on the plane. And when I got there in the morning, she was in the morgue.
Hmm.
And she had passed away. And of course, something like that, you know, no history of being sick, mm-hmm. had gone to the doctor a week before, and mm-hmm. was planning to go somewhere, and, you know, just talked on the phone.
Mm-hmm.
And that was quite a shock.
Mm-hmm. How old was she?
57, I believe, when she went.
Pretty young.
And it was just something,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Mm-hmm.
And we were involved with the church here, the first church that we came down, and the people were so supportive, and you know, they drove up to Virginia because we had a funeral in New York, and then the family burial plot is up in Virginia. So we came down and had a second service, and they came up with us and all that. So it was a humbling experience, let's put it that way.
Okay. I wonder if you could sort of tell me, give me an idea of what going to school in Brooklyn was like, and whether you were involved in any type of community activities in Brooklyn when, you know, as a young kid.
I don't know where it came from. Perhaps maybe the values that were instilled in Virginia. But I always tried to get involved with things at school, extracurricular activities. I played sports. I was on the safety patrol. Junior high school, I was in the, I got a service award, and you know, I always had an inclination to do more than the average for some reason. I don't know why, because at that time it was, you know, just get by and get out. I tell you what, New York is supposed to be a melting pot, but there was such a difference. Now, we went to a public school 3 or 4 blocks away, and I did very well in my classes. But when we went to junior high school, which was in a predominantly white neighborhood, George Gershwin, I was so far behind. Well, let's back up a little bit. When I came from Virginia, I was in the fifth grade. I was supposed to go into the fifth grade. So coming from the South, they wanted to put me back a grade because we were supposed to be, you know, such country bumpkins. So anyway, I passed the test, so they put me in the fifth grade. So I didn't lose any time. And from then until junior high school age, I did very well. And I ended up in 7-Eleven. Now, there's 22 seventh grade classes. So, to me, that's telling me I'm average. Okay. And then they had about 5 or 6 SP classes. This was the special children. I think they call them advanced now or whatever they do. And they were predominantly white. And then you started with your 7-1, so it got dumber and dumber as the numbers went up. 7-22 was the lamp makers, you know, we used to call those, you know, all they had the ability to do was, you know, something like that. So that's when I found out how far behind I was in education. And then as you get older and you find out that you'll have the hand-me-down books and you're already behind, even though you're doing well, you're still not up with the, you know, with the rest of the country. So anyway, that opened my eyes a little bit. I went to the New York School of Printing because I got introduced to printing in junior high school. And I had a teacher that happened to care about students. And he thought I had the ability to, you know, do that type of work. And I did, and I liked it. So I applied for the New York School of Printing, which means you have to take a test and all that. So I took the test, got into school. Went through that, and my ambition was to become a four-color pressman, which at that time was paying a lot of money, and a trade, because I didn't have any reason to think I was going to college because the money wasn't there, and I didn't have any scholarships being offered to me. So I was going to take a trade. So I went to school, so I did well in school, and the guy says, well, why don't you go to school? You know, I'm going, what school? So I ended up in community college for graphic arts and advertising technology. And while I was in school, that's when I got the job at the New York Times.
Okay, and what community college was this?
That was, what was the name of that thing? It's NYC, New York City Community College, NYCCC. And I went there at night for 4 years, got the associate degree. But I was working, I think near the last year I started working at the Times. And I stayed there for 13 years, then transferred down here for another 2 years.
And do you remember what year you began working for the Times?
1967 or 68, somewhere okay. along in there. And I worked for them until another 15 years total.
Mm-hmm.
And the 3 years of that, I was down here transferred with a company called Microfilming Corporation, which was a New York Times company.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how I got down here. After they sold the company to a Michigan outfit, I didn't want to go back to the snow. So I stayed down here, and that's when I had all these odd jobs until I got back into my trade. And I ended up at a place called AMI in Burlington, American mm-hmm. Multimedia,
mm-hmm.
which did CDs and cassettes, but also they had a print shop. And I was the, I guess you want to call it office manager, purchasing manager, estimator, and a whole lot of other things, scheduling. And I stayed there until I was, until I came full-time into the ministry.
Hmm.
So basically, that's my work history.
Okay, wonderful. So, sort of just going back to Brooklyn, I kind of want to get a sense of how you came to meet your wife, and sort of give me a flavor of that.
Well, I guess I grew up to be, I wouldn't say a hardened criminal, but I wasn't an angel, let's put it that way.
Somewhere
in New York, there was also always hustles going on, and what I mean by hustles is, a friend of mine, Jim Fitzgerald, that worked at the Times, ran into a guy that made slugs that would fit in the token booth.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so we got into selling slugs there, one bags of them for $10 or $15. You get 100 of them. This little, you know, they fit in the subway. So anyway, apparently we weren't the only ones selling them, and the transit authority found out about it. And one of the girls that was in the office who bought some, they caught her going through the turnstile, you know, and they made her undress. And I mean, it was really an embarrassing experience, you know. So she came in late crying and all upset. So we kind of stopped that. But, you know, things like that, you know, we used to call it hustling, making extra money, you know, selling this, selling all kinds of stuff. So by no means was Wade Bowick an angel. I, you know, I did my little dirt too. But I never did anything that, you know, any harm against a person, you mm-hmm. know, any kind of robbery or anything like that. But I did my share of things that could have landed me in jail, let's put it that way.
Could you describe the slugs? And
the slugs, well, in New York, when I first got there, I think tokens were 10 cents.
Okay.
And they were small, the size of a dime, and they always had a Y stamped right, you know, it was a shape of a Y spaced through it so that when you put it in the turnstile, that's what would click into the machine.
Mm-hmm.
Then people start duplicating, so they change the size and the price. I think now it's $1.75 for that same 10 cent mm-hmm. token. But the slugs were sort of a magnesium lightweight type metal, the same thickness as the tokens that were being used, but they didn't have the Y slotted, but we found out that it would work.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And I guess whoever was doing this in the machine shop was just stamping out these things, putting them in a bag and selling them. So at that time, I think it was like 50 cents a piece. And if you could buy this thing for 10 or 15 cents and get on the subway, then mm-hmm. you're way ahead of the game.
Right. Okay.
So that's how that racket, I call it a racket, started. And some other things that I would not put on tape because they might arrest me. But anyway, you know, we used to call it hustling, selling stuff and doing things to make extra money.
Mm-hmm.
I started to play semi-professional football when I was 19 with a team called the Golden Knights in Brooklyn. And during that period of time, the discotheques were up and running, and several of the guys on the team used to do, we used to bounce at these clubs. So I ended up with three jobs there at one time. I was working at the Times, I was working in the liquor store part-time, and I was bouncing at these clubs. So I was doing well as far as making money.
Mm-hmm.
One night we're at this club, and we're downstairs, this one-way in, one-way out thing, and this guy comes by, he's young, he's got sneakers on, the show was on, it's about midnight, and we wouldn't let him in. So, took him upstairs, next thing I know, shooting going on. So, the place was near Linden Boulevard, which is a big street through Brooklyn, goes all the way to Queens. And it has a service road.
Mm-hmm.
And it just happened that a police car was coming down the service road and heard the shots. And when they pulled up, those kids had a shopping bag full of guns.
Mm.
They dropped the bag and scattered. And the guy that did the shooting ran right into the police car. He was high off of some kind of drugs
mm-hmm.
anyway. So they caught him. But that's when I realized that my life was worth more than $75 a night.
Mm-hmm. You know what
I
mean?
So I kind of got out of that business. And always, you know, trying to do something extra to, you know, to get by. And that's called life on the street.
Mm-hmm.
Never bothered with any drugs or anything like that. As far as selling it, you know, I tried a few things, but mainly alcohol and cigarettes was what I did. And like I say, I did some other things that I'm not proud of.
Mm-hmm.
But I have repented for all of these things. So basically, that's what it was. It was street life. Sometimes you had to fight, you know, to survive. You know. For instance, Broadway Junction on the subway was a place where just about all the trains merged, coming from all directions,
mm-hmm.
and you make your connections going to whichever neighborhood you're going to. And after school, depending on how many gang members collected at the station, who ruled the station.
Mm-hmm.
See what I'm saying? So everybody had to come upstairs to where all the trains, you know, sort of had a little, that's why they call it a junction. And you have to come upstairs into this one particular area before you can make your other connections. And that's where the majority ruled. So you never knew what gang was up there that particular day, you know. And if something had happened a day or two before, or somebody got beat up from one gang or the other gang, you know, they'd be looking for a particular group, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So that's when I experienced, I don't know if you've ever seen the subway or L. The L was above ground.
Mm-hmm.
And when you look down between those railroad ties, you see the street, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You're running up there on this little three-board catwalk
mm-hmm.
trying to get away from something that's real dangerous.
Yeah.
And some people didn't make it. So I've been in some places and some life-threatening things and all sorts of little things. But
And sort of what have these experiences meant to you?
Well, coming from that environment, I can somewhat understand some of these kids, what they're going through in these projects in these neighborhoods.
Mm-hmm.
And when you understand something, you can help.
Mm-hmm.
And I never look down at my nose at anybody because, you know, I've done some things I'm not proud of either. And I realize that you can come from that environment and make something out of your life.
Mm-hmm.
With a little push, a little help in the right direction,
mm-hmm.
you know. And that's why I'm involved with this child evangelism, and as far as the body is concerned, and not from a church standpoint, because I think when blacks and whites and other races get together and go into the neighborhoods and say the same thing, then you have a better chance. And what's happening here is that all the churches, the Muslims, the Jehovah Witnesses, the Baptists, the Full Gospel, everybody's going into the neighborhoods and they're telling the people that you need to do this in order to embrace my religion.
Right.
And we're telling them you need salvation in Jesus Christ.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can decide what church you want to go to.
Mm-hmm.
It takes the confusion out of it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I'm fighting for. But a lot of people can't get past there because they don't understand those kids. They don't know what makes them tick. They don't know what happens when they're looking out the window and they see somebody get shot,
mm-hmm.
or somebody in their family. You know, and it's traumatic. You know, they feel like they're losers, that they can never win, you know. And I know that myself and a lot of us made it out of Brownsville. You know, a lot of us made it out, made good things in life, you know. Some went to Hollywood, and we had one that John Redwood ended up as an actor, and we had some basketball players.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of good came out of the bad, okay? So what it gave me was an understanding of what happens and what life means living in places like
mm-hmm.
that, because I was there, you know.
Just quickly, sort of wanted to sort of get a quick account of how you met your wife and...
Well, I had a friend of mine also. Well, most of my friends at that time, we all played football together, so we all kind of hung out together. And he had a girlfriend that was having a party, and it turned out to be a divorce party for my wife's sister. So I ended up meeting her at a divorce party for her sister. So we met, and I don't think she liked me too much, but I certainly did like her. And we ended up, well, actually we shacked up together, I'm not proud to say, for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And then she again being, a woman of faith who had gotten away from it, didn't feel right, you know. She wasn't. You know, so she kind of insisted that we get married, and we did, you know. So like I say, wasn't an angel all my
mm-hmm.
life, you know. But we got back together, and she was wanting to get away from New York, but I told her I was getting a transfer, and she told me, I'm not going down there in those bushes, you know. I don't know nobody down there. I'm not going, so... Now when we go back to New York, she won't spend more than a day, and she's ready to come back. So she's acclimated and happy and glad we made the change. And again, being people of faith, we realized that there was a purpose in it,
mm-hmm.
that we ended up here in Durham. And it turned out to be the ministry. So.
So when did you two get married?
1977.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. And you had four children?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do they live?
No, I'm 77. 87. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Okay. And do the children live in this area, or are they...
Yeah, they're all here. My oldest son, Alfred, he's kind of like his father. He's doing newspapers, he works mm-hmm. in the school, and he's got a barbershop. So he's working, he's married, he's got two children.
Mm-hmm.
My oldest daughter, who just left, she worked for us, and she was going to work in the prisons. Mm. So she's in transition right now. My youngest son, he was the one at the desk there. He just made us grandparents.
Oh.
So him and his wife, they both work here. She works as a teacher downstairs. And he works here as maintenance.
Mm-hmm.
And then my youngest daughter is still home, Dion. She's 13.
Mm.
and doing very well in school. I might add. She has an ambition to be a doctor, and wonderful. I think she'll make it.
Wonderful. Okay, so they're all in the dorm area.
All here.
Just trying to get a sense of race relations. Your take on race relations up in the North versus what you may have experienced in the South, living with your aunt and uncle. Or...
in Virginia is really when I got a taste of racism, pure, outright hate. We'd be walking down the road to the school, and they'd come by in a car and throw a bottle at you and call you this and that.
They being?
White folks, you know. And, you know, just outright attacks, you know, with the segregated bathrooms and the restaurants and all that kind of stuff. And that's when, you know, coming from the North, you didn't really see it that way, but it was there, okay? But when I got to Virginia, that's when I really experienced the division among the races. And basically, that's all it was. It was just black and white. You didn't have many immigrants or anything at that time. So people in the South that are really from the South do have more of a problem when immigrants start to come in, you know, because they're just not used to it. Now, in the North, like I said, segregation was kind of hidden. And yes, we worked together and all of that, but when you got to Broadway Junction, the white went to the white neighborhood. You see what I'm saying? So there were some neighborhoods that, for instance, when we moved to Brownsville, there was a lot of white people still there. But as the blacks started to come in, the whites started to move out. And the only ones that were trapped were the elderly because they had no place to go. And then after the blacks, then when Eisenhower made that thing with Puerto Rico, then the Puerto Ricans started coming in, okay? And then, you know, you kind of feel like you're getting pushed upon. But then again, we all started getting together and, you know, understanding each other and becoming friends.
How did that happen?
You mean as far as friends?
Yeah, how did that process evolve?
Mainly by going to school. When you go to school, everybody's, you know, everybody's strung together, okay? Then what happens is the neighborhood thing, okay? So you get back to the territory, and it doesn't matter if you're white, black, blue, or green. If you live in Brownsville, you got to get back home. So we all pull together, you see? So it's kind of a funny thing that happens there. Then what happens, you begin to know each other, and then you start hanging out together, and then, you know, you become friends, you know? When I went to high school, the guys that I hung around with, one of my friends, Palmer, was Italian, Barrios was Puerto Rican, and me, and we were the three amigos, and we hung out all through high school. I'd like to find those guys. I don't know what happened. I know Palmer went into the Marines, went to Vietnam, Barrios I lost track of. But, I mean, we were really friends. We went to each other's house, and, you know, which was an experience because then, you know, we were different neighborhoods. But basically, we all got together and got along together, you know. So that's why I'm saying coming from the North, there's more tolerance for other races, for different people coming in, you know. I think down here, people perceive that as a threat. Or competition for jobs, but this area is low unemployment, so there's work for everybody, you know. So we had a problem in this neighborhood where there was a certain segment of people, or black people, were preying on the Mexicans.
Could you explain that?
They would rob them. The Mexicans are known for carrying their money and keeping their money with them.
Yes.
Because they don't trust the banks because, you know, what's happening in Mexico.
So, and what is happening in Mexico?
Well, I went down there. We went there a couple of years to Cancun for a vacation. And the exchange rates depends on where you go.
Mm-hmm.
We went to the bank once because they, at this particular bank, was given the best exchange rate for dollars.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure what the mistrust stems from, but they don't do a lot of, you know, taking their money, and I'm saying hard-earned money because these people work hard.
Mm-hmm.
And I do have respect for them as a race. When we're riding down the street and the work that's being done here with backhoes and automated equipment, they're doing with picks and shovels in that hot sun.
Mm-hmm.
So these are hardworking people. And I guess when they get those pesos, you know, they want to keep those pesos that they got, and they don't want that money fluctuating every day. It's worth less, it's worth more,
exactly.
You know.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know what it is, but perhaps further in the study, that would be a point to find
mm-hmm.
out. But somehow they have a mistrust for banks. And, you know, they keep a lot of cash on them. They keep the cash in the house. And I don't know if they're still doing that, but that was what they were doing when they first came, and people knew that, you know, so they would rob them. So they finally caught this group that was preying on them.
Mm-hmm.
And I haven't heard too much about stuff going on. We are in a high crime area here.
Mm-hmm.
And we're here for the neighborhood, which we're trying to get these people to understand. A couple of weeks ago, they called me 4:30 in the morning and kicked the front door in.
Who's they?
Somebody. I don't know. Somebody mm-hmm. came in to rob something.
Okay.
But we're here to give to the neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've paid rent, we've paid heating bills, water bills. You know, we're not here to block out the neighborhood. We're here to embrace the
mm-hmm.
neighborhood. So, but whoever this person is had to be drugged out of their mind. You
mm-hmm.
know, the door says ADT security. You know.
Right.
So it was the minute you kick the door and the alarm's going off, you know,
right.
So they didn't catch him, but they didn't get anything.
When did this happen?
This was about 3 or 4 weeks ago.
Okay.
But we've had several attempts around here.
Was this, had something like this happened at the church before?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, they tried all kinds of stuff. But, you know, and that's one thing we're trying to get across to the neighborhood. And we're not a church that sits inside the walls.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we go out, we talk to people, we help people.
Mm-hmm.
We have clothes, we have furniture back here that they're welcome to have. All you have to do is ask for it, you know. So I guess it gets you down sometimes,
mm-hmm.
you know, when you see people do stuff like that. But then you have to look at the reason.
What's the racial composition of the area in which the church sits, did you say?
I had a survey somewhere. It's predominantly black.
Mm-hmm.
Still has a good portion of Caucasians. I would say still above 25%.
Mm-hmm.
A small Indian population. And then those were the last census figures, but I'm sure now there's quite a few Mexicans added into the pot, and they've concentrated in certain areas within this northeast central Durham.
Do you have a sense of where those areas of concentration are?
Yeah, because Saturday when we're riding around to pick up, we do pick up quite a few Mexican children.
Mm-hmm.
Liberty Square, which is on Alston Avenue, is just about all Mexican now. What's that? Juniper Square is about all Mexicans. That's right down the street down here.
Mm-hmm.
There's a high concentration of Mexicans in this area as far as houses and apartments, but they kind of gravitate to these large, low-rent apartment areas.
Mm-hmm.
And from my experience in Brooklyn, a family will come over and they'll hook up with their cousins, and they'll get an apartment, and there'll be 15 people in that apartment. And people would talk, look at them people over there. But within a year, they all have cars. Some of them have stores, you
mm-hmm.
know, Brooklyn was known in New York, period, for, we used to call them Puerto Rican stores.
Mm-hmm.
They get a store, they get a cab. They see the opportunities that we don't see.
Yes.
You see? And then people somehow, when they get ahead or when they surpass them, then they're mad. Well, look at these people. They can get this. Well, you can do this. You've been here. You were born here. Why can't you have what you want?
Have black residents communicated that to you?
No, around here, I don't have too much of that other than, you know, what the neighborhood itself was doing.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this church, we embrace everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't have any Mexican members, but we do have some Mexican people that visit occasionally. We have given food and milk and bread and clothes to Mexicans as well as anybody else that would ask for it. Caucasian, it doesn't matter, you know. But we believe here that we must love everybody. So we're not, as far as this church is concerned, we embrace everybody.
Mm-hmm.
You know, don't turn anybody away. And we don't teach that.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, the Bible says that you can't hate your neighbor and love God,
right,
whom you've never seen. So, I don't know what these people think, but people are people. Now, the blacks are stereotyped, you know, we're muggers, we're this, we're that,
mm-hmm,
and so is most other races. I think people resent